Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Daniel Dennett is one of the most celebrated philosophers of our time, a prolific writer, thinker, and speaker, and a giant in the field of cognitive science and philosophy. He's the author of more than a dozen books, including Consciousness Explained, which argued that the human brain is a type of computer, and Darwin's Dangerous Idea, which aimed to explain all of human existence not through religion, but through natural selection. Now Dennett has a new book with the wonderfully provocative title, From Bacteria to Bach and Back, The Evolution of the Human Mind. Daniel Dennett is a professor of philosophy at Tufts University, and he joins me now in the studio. Professor Dennett, welcome back to Radio Boston. It's great to meet you, and thank you for coming in.
I'm delighted to be here, Anthony.
The very first questions on the first page of your book are these. How come there are minds, and how is it possible for minds to ask and answer that question? And I love that as a starting point, and I'd love to just sort of put that out there and get you to, a book follows those questions, but answer that, take a shot at that question or those questions.
The reason why the question is so difficult is because we have to start with the beginning of life on the planet. Yeah. And what we have to realize is that even the very first living things, things like bacteria, were tremendously complex, and it was as if they had minds. They were very competent at staying alive and reproducing. And what Darwin showed, and has been confirmed 100 times, 1,000 times over ever since, is that a completely natural, material, purposeless, godless process of natural selection has generated over billions of years ever increasingly complex minds, brains, and we human beings are the possessors of the most amazing minds of all. In fact, our minds are unique in many different ways, but that doesn't make them supernatural. They are natural parts of the natural world, and the hard part is explaining how that can possibly be so.
How that could possibly be so, thinking about the way life evolves over the millennia from these little bacteria and little globs of life, and then suddenly we have these amazing things on our heads that arguably give us consciousness, although I know this is one of the big questions that you get into.
Well, consciousness is certainly the highlight of the human mind.
Right.
But it's not quite so magical and mysterious as a lot of people think. For a lot of people, if you don't mean something almost supernatural by consciousness, then you're not talking about consciousness. And for 50 years, I've been trying to argue, no, it's wonderful. It's just the greatest gee whiz marvel of all, but it's not supernatural and it's not immaterial. We can explain it all in terms of what's going on in brains and the things out in the world that those brains are responding to.
Well, I want to get to that. I want to sort of ask a kind of a silly question, because as I told you before we started recording, this has been by my bed for the last couple of nights, and I've been really enjoying getting into this book. But I was staring at my cat, and I'm thinking, so that's my cat. He's got a little brain. This is me. I've got a big brain. I'm conscious of that. I know that my cat isn't thinking the way that I'm thinking. You know, he's sort of responding to what's warm and where the food is and all that. But I got to believe that apart from the pure biology, there's something that separates us, and that's my ability to basically describe what I just described, which is a way of saying consciousness, isn't it?
Well, that's what separates you from your cat, but I wouldn't call that consciousness. The cat is sentient. The cat has pain and loves warmth and has pretty good eyesight and very good hearing and very good sense of smell, and all of these contribute to the cat's getting through the day quite gracefully,
right,
and successfully. You've got that too, and so does every living thing on the planet have that basic set of competences, some much more than others. What distinguishes your mind from the cat's mind is that the cat's got, you might say, a bare brain, doesn't have any thinking tools. You, however, have been picking up thinking tools since since you were born.
Now, you write about this. Explain what you mean by thinking tools, because I love this concept that you describe.
Well, there's tools like hammers and telescopes and screwdrivers, which are concrete material objects. Right. But then there's tools that are ways of doing things, like long division or finding the average or speaking. Yeah. And every word in your vocabulary is a thinking tool. Where do they come from? Who invented them? Nobody. That is, there are tools that have inventors, that have authors. There are words that have been coined. But those are a tiny fraction of the very latest tools. And how were they possible? How could we have intelligent designers, human beings, that made wonderful things like computers and telescopes and sonnets and symphonies and all the rest? The answer is there's a second evolutionary process just as natural as Darwinian natural selection of genes, and that's natural selection of cultural items, of thinking tools, really.
Thinking tools, huh.
And they didn't start out being tools. They just were things that could replicate sort of the way viruses do.
Yeah. So in other words, we acquire and evolve thinking tools because it's the way that we essentially stay alive, very much like animals will develop wings or abilities to walk and opposable thumbs and all these kinds of things.
Birds make nests. Yeah. Spiders weave webs. So and we weave webs of words.
Yeah.
And without them, we'd be pretty helpless. And we acquire our raw materials for this not through our genes. Huh. We acquire them through our upbringing and through just being alive and out in the world and looking at things. We pick up thousands of well-designed thinking tools, and we install them like apps in our necktop.
It's a great image. But what is this? Doesn't this raise big questions about free will? I mean, if we're thinking about sort of higher intellectual abilities as being developed like, muscles on our body, aren't we in a way saying that we're not really using our brains to express free will in the way that we think we are?
The problem with the concept of free will is that there are two quite different notions which are often run together and really, I've argued, have very little to do with each other. One of them is the idea that we are somehow, when we make a decision, we're physically cut off from any earlier sources of causation. That's the idea that our free will must be undetermined by the fabric of causation of the past.
Right.
That's baloney. First of all, if it were true, you couldn't be responsible for it. It would be like rolling the dice. It would be like a quantum effect roulette wheel. You couldn't be responsible for anything you do because it wouldn't be the result of your thinking, which in turn was the result of your learning and your discussions with other people and your acculturation, your moral upbringing, all the rest. We don't want to be cut off from that. Mm-hmm. We want that to play a very significant role in turning us into responsible agents. So the idea of indeterministic free will is a several thousand-year-old mistake. But there is a very good notion of free will, often called compatibilist, which says free will is compatible with determinism or indeterminism. Physics has nothing to do with it. Free will is a very special suite of competences that most normal human beings have. No bears or monkeys or donkeys have it.
Mm-hmm.
Small children don't have it. People who are deranged or have pathological neural conditions very often don't have it. It's the capacity to think ahead, to be moved by reasons, to be capable of self-control, and to have, you might say, moral imagination. That is a very real phenomenon. It has evolved culturally and genetically. It is something that Some people don't have it. And sometimes it's not their fault. They've been afflicted in some way. Each of us who does have it has a certain responsibility to keep ourselves in that state.
I want to ask you about something else. You're among the leading thinkers on atheism, and you wrote the book Breaking the Spell, Religion as a Natural Phenomenon, in 2006. And you've been called a Darwinian fundamentalist for your views on the divine. Is there space for divine design in your explanation of the mind?
Absolutely not.
Okay,
in Darwin's Dangerous Idea, I introduced a pair of terms, skyhook and crane. Cranes are not miraculous. Skyhooks of the kind that you just hang in the sky and you can lift things.
They don't work so well.
That's a fantasy. That's magic. It doesn't happen. And ever since Darwin, the big question has been, can we get all the way to us, all the way to Shakespeare and Bach and Jane Austen and wonderfulness, can we get all the way there from bacteria?
Yeah.
And the natural answer is yes, and it's all done with cranes. Hmm. No skyhooks. There's no role for any skyhooks. They're not needed.
Great image there. From bacteria to Bach and back. So what's the concern about? I mean, I'm assuming it's a concern. I mean, can we go back from Bach?
We're now living in the age of intelligent design. A lot of intelligent designers out there, artists and scientists and technicians and people that make computers and games and political parties and all of this. So we unquestionably, there are now plenty of intelligent designers, human beings. The age of intelligent design is only a few thousand years old. Go back 10,000 years to the birth of agriculture, and that's got most of it. There's a little, of course, everything starts gradually. We're now entering the age of post-intelligent design.
Hmm.
Because what we've learned as intelligent designers is that evolution is cleverer than we are at some things. So we're now turning to making technologies that are fundamentally Darwinian, or they're versions of natural selection. And this is things like deep learning, the program that won, that beat the world's Go champion, AlphaGo, the other day. These are technologies which do their work the way natural selection does. Mindlessly, without consciousness, without forethought, they grind out better and better and better and better and better designs. And now we have, in effect, black boxes that a scientist can use, where they put in the data, they push the button, out comes an answer. They know it's a good answer. They have no idea how it got there. This is black box science. This is returning to our Darwinian roots.
Interesting.
And giving up on the idea of comprehension.
Well, let me, final question, because we're up against the clock here, but speaking of artificial intelligence, does that mean artificial intelligence will evolve like the human brain and surpass the human brain?
Oh, artificial intelligence has already surpassed the human brain in many obvious ways.
Right. I mean in the big sort of cosmic way.
Yeah. I think, although that's possible in principle, and some people make a great deal of this, and they imagine a coming age where we have a super intelligence that will simply leave us in the dirt. I don't think it's going to happen. I think it's much, much harder and more expensive than people realize. And we're better off using tools, not trying to make colleagues. There are plenty of colleagues around. And so we don't need conscious robots. We need unconscious robots that will do slave labor, and it won't be a bad thing for them to do it, because they won't have feelings, they won't have rights. You can take them apart, you can throw them away.
And we can control them.
And we can control them.
Well, Daniel Dennett, what a pleasure talking to you. He's the professor of philosophy and co-director of the Center for Cognitive Studies at Tufts University. His new book is From Bacteria to Bach and Back, The Evolution of the Human Mind. Professor Dennett, thanks so much for coming in to talk to us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. I enjoyed talking with you.
And stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.